Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. It is our members who make this show possible, and you can join them. All you need to do is to walk into another dimension where you become a member of the Ring of Fire Radio show, and that is over at rofpodcast.com. Walking through that other dimension just costs a couple of quarters a day, and you get two times more of the show. Plus, you get full access to our 10 years worth of archives, and you help keep this show on the air. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Middle East expert Juan Cole will join us to discuss the fallout from a recent drone attack on a Saudi Arabian oil field. Ari Berman from Mother Jones stops by to give us an update on the state of voting rights across the United States. Heather Digby Parton will be here to help me run down a busy week in the news, and our progressive candidate spotlight this week will be with Erica Vladimir, who's running against incumbent Carolyn Maloney in New York's 12th District. You're listening to the radio right now. You should know there's a free one-hour podcast to Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. There's also a member show, which you can support this program by going to rofpodcast.com. You get the three-hour radio show without commercials and access to 10 years of archives. That's rofpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down a busy week in the news. Heather Digby Parton from the blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, obviously, some of the most, life and death news of the week, at least, in terms of world peace, centers around Iran. I will be talking to Professor Juan Cole in the bottom half of the hour of this program, and we'll be touching on that. And suffice it to say that hopefully with John Bolton out of the White House and with Donald Trump afraid that if he doesn't get reelected, he's going to go to prison, he will avoid some type of unnecessary conflict with Iran. Best case scenario, of course, is that he decides that he's going to make the same deal that Barack Obama did in terms of nukes, and just simply call it the Trump deal, and he will have his ego stroked and save the world an unnecessary another massive war in the Middle East. But with that said, let's turn to what took place in this country this week. A lot of news, a lot of stories about Donald Trump and his administration assaulting our administrative state and the protections for us as citizens, as consumers, as human beings. Really interesting developments on the impeachment front. And this is what we saw this week with Corey Lewandowski was important in and of itself, but it was also important because it reflects back on a vote that was taken on the Judiciary Committee last week about changing their procedures. I know you wrote a piece about this. Why don't you just lay out what we saw this week?
The vote you refer to, the Judiciary Committee last week, voted for a number of changes and to just clarify how they were going to go forward with this, the impeachment inquiry, investigation, not impeachment, whatever you wanted to call it. They clearly made some changes going forward in order to run these hearings differently than they normally do. And it turns out to have been an extremely important vote, maybe one of the most important votes that they have taken so far in how they are going to conduct these impeachment hearings. which were billed as impeachment hearings, by the way. I mean, it's Judiciary Committee. It's not the full House, and it's not an impeachment per se, but it is an impeachment hearing, and they called it that, so that's something. But the rule that I'm referring to is the one which would allow staff attorneys to question witnesses for half an hour at a time. Now, that may not seem like much, but some of us who have been around a long time and watched hearings in the past with, you know, in Watergate and in Iran-Contra and others, the best hearings, the ones which really elicited the most information, were basically run by attorneys doing, you know, a real cross-examination without this five-minute rule and without the showboating and without the, you know, the Congress people using it as a platform for themselves. And to be fair, on the Judiciary Committee, there are probably some really good lawyers on that committee on the Democratic side, someone like Jamie Raskin, for instance. But, you know, you even Clarence Darrow couldn't do a great job if they only have 5 minutes to ask somebody something, at which point it switches over to the other side and you go off on a completely different tangent. So it's just not a good process for actually eliciting information and conveying to the people who are watching what they're really trying to get at, what the committee is trying to get at by, you know, asking these people questions. Because face facts, most of the time, they know what they're trying to get right them to say, and it's a very difficult process to do it. So they changed the rule, or they went back to a previous rule, which allowed for this half hour of questioning. And this week, they brought in Lewandowski, Trump's former campaign manager. They had asked for two others, a guy named Rick Dearborn, who worked in the administration, and Rob Porter, which I'm sure everybody remembers, was the secretary to Trump and very much involved at a very high level. And he was ousted over reports that he had abused his former wives.
Right, which is not to be confused with the other administration officials who left because of also reported domestic abuse issues. But go ahead.
Right. I mean, it's hard to keep track. There are so many. But in any case, he including the president himself, by the way. So in any case, the White House has been evoking this bizarre, you know, unlimited, what do they call it? Absolute immunity from anyone who worked in the White House from having to testify before Congress. And apparently this rule did exist prior to now, but it's never been used in this way. And what it does essentially is just say, you can't ask us any questions about anything we did in the executive branch. And it goes beyond what we normally think of as executive privilege, although they're using that as well, and they're using this thing called testimony privilege. There's a whole bunch of various stonewalling techniques that the White House is using. Lewandowski was different because he never worked in the White House. He never had an official government position. So theoretically, he should not be subject to any of this, even if that is, a proper use of these particular rules and privileges. Lewandowski, of all people, shouldn't be subject to it. But in the end, they came up with this, you know, rule. I mean, they basically commanded Lewandowski not to answer any questions about anything that wasn't in the Mueller report. And, of course, Lewandowski happily, you know, followed orders because he, you know, didn't want to answer any questions. And so this became, you know, when we watched the hearings, yeah, it seemed like the Democrats were very hapless. The first half of the hearings were just kind of disastrous. And I mean, you can't, it's victim blaming to just sort of say, well, they handled it wrong, because when you have a witness like that under those rules of this five minute rule, it's very, very difficult. And it didn't go well. The media declared it a disaster. It was, you know, not a good thing. But when they came back, and by the way, even within that, and it was kind of a circus, and of course the Republicans were acting like, you know, teenage gang members. I mean, they were absolutely outrageous as always. Even within that, they did get Lewandowski to repeatedly say that what was in the Mueller report was correct. And it had to do with Lewandowski being asked by Donald Trump to go to former Attorney General Jeff Sessions and tell him to unrecuse himself and to make a speech saying he's unrecusing himself and directing the Russia investigation to only look at elections going forward and to not look at 2016. And
I want to reiterate that, and then I want to take a break here because we're up against a break, but this is really important. You know, Donald Trump wanted Lewandowski, who is not working at the White House, former campaign, and Lewandowski was hoping to get back into the White House at this point. Right. Donald Trump asked him, Jeff Sessions to deliver the speech, like you say, saying that Donald Trump is completely exonerated, saying that the investigation's only going to look at future potential meddling in the election, which is stunning. I don't know how you investigate that, pre-crime, I guess. Obviously Jeff Sessions would have to recuse himself, recuse his recusal and jump back in. So Lewandowski is tasked with this. Let's take a break, because when we return, we'll talk about how committee lawyer impeached so much of Lewandowski's testimony, and we can start to see the outlines of what an impeachment indictment would look like on obstruction of justice. We will take a quick break. When we come back, Digby and I will talk more about this. I'm Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio.
I had a dream about a burning house. You were stuck inside, I couldn't get you out. I laid beside you and pulled you close. And the two of us went up in smoke.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, before we broke, you basically walked us through these hearings with Corey Lewandowski this week, where Lewandowski, the thing that the Democrats wanted to show was that Lewandowski, once he was tasked by the president to go and tell Jeff Sessions to unrecuse himself from the Mueller investigation, to announce that the Mueller investigation was only going to investigate stuff that could possibly happen in the future, not that it happened in the past, and to say Donald Trump was completely cleared. So Lewandowski is tasked to doing this, and this is all in the Mueller report, but the what is happening here is that the committee wants to prove or show that Lewandowski knew that that request was illegal. That in and of itself, if he had gone and done what the president had asked him to do, that he would be breaking the law because he would be a party, an accomplice to the obstruction of justice. All right, so pick it up from there. Lewandowski is admitting that what's in the Mueller report is true. And then the committee staffer on the Judiciary Committee continues to press him.
Right. After they broke, they brought in this attorney. His name is Barry Burke, and he's obviously very, he's an excellent lawyer. And he had 30 minutes to draw this out. And it's exactly what you say. They needed to get Lewandowski to admit in some fashion or another, first, that the Mueller report was correct. They needed to get that on the congressional record, that the participant in that, when he said under oath what he said to Mueller, that he was standing by that, and Lewandowski did that, you know, with a bunch of folderol all around it, but essentially that's what he got to. And they also wanted to get Lewandowski to, you know, to draw out the fact that Lewandowski knew that he was doing something potentially illegal. And the way that they did that, and it was very clever and, you know, an excellent sort of way to have a cross-examination in a hearing, this attorney, you know, talked to him about the fact that he put this message, which was apparently dictated to him by the president, put it in a safe and didn't do anything with it. And, you know, obviously, I mean, you know, Lewandowski said, well, I went on vacation. Being with my kids was more important than, you know, doing a mission for the president of the United States. So he didn't do it. And, you know, obviously what he was hoping was that the president would forget about it, because he does this all the time, right? He issues all kinds of orders, just like Richard Nixon did, by the way, you know, the firebombing of Brookings and things like that. These authoritarian types are always issuing orders, and a lot of his, you know, his minions sort of hope he doesn't really want to follow through, and that was probably the case here. But the president did think about it again, brought it up to him a month later, and furthermore said that he should go to Sessions and say if Sessions refuses to meet with him, that he's fired. And Lewandowski again left that meeting and turned it over to this guy, Rick Dearborn, who was a staffer at the time in the White House, and that was that. And by doing this, it indicates that there's this whole sort of thing going on in the Trump administration at this time where there were a bunch of people who knew about this obstruction of justice and who were basically, you know, potentially working as accomplices to it. And what this did was it put Lewandowski on the hook as being someone who was in legal, you know, in legal jeopardy for having done what he did. You know, Mueller didn't give him immunity. Well, you know, the Congress has a different set of possibilities that they can do. First of all, he could be held in contempt, and you can be held in contempt of Congress, and that's a different thing than being given immunity by the special counsel. So all of this is sort of, you can see that they're starting to build this case for impeachment one by one, and that the White House is making it tremendously difficult to do this by withholding witnesses from them, but they're going to go after it anyway. And I think, you know, the Mueller report is only part of this, right? I mean, this is something the judiciary committee already has the outlines of the impeachment. There are 10 potential obstruction cases in the Mueller report, but there's also this obstruction of Congress, which is something that Nadler said to Lewandowski, and this was important. He said, you know, remember, one of the impeachment counts against President Nixon was obstruction of Congress.
Right.
And he says, you know, and you are helping the president right now commit another, he didn't say this out loud, but this is what he was saying, you're helping him commit another impeachable offense. So you can see where they're going. If they can get there, you know, good luck to them. It's very difficult, but they are, you know, I was a little heartened to see that they actually put this guy out there with a half an hour to nail Lewandowski. And by the way, Lewandowski crumbled. He was very cocky in the beginning, and by the end of it, he was sputtering and, you know, obviously nervous because he could see that he had been cornered. So they need to do this going forward at all the hearings.
Well, I think, you know, like I say, we saw a preview of what that looks like when they have a staffer actually doing this type of questioning. Mm-hmm. And I suspect, too, they also learned that maybe this is what we should put up top. Maybe we could do we could bring a half hour in the beginning, half hour at the end might be the best way to approach this, because, again, this is all about building public support. We got to take a break. We got more to talk about on the impeachment front in the next hour, but we've got a lot of other stories, and we will be back to discuss those. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with Professor Juan Cole, and then join us in the next hour. We'll be talking to Digby again. Coming up, Middle East expert Juan Cole on Trump's flirtation with war with Iran. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. President Trump has a serious infatuation with strong men and dictators, which was highlighted this week after a drone attack on a Saudi oil field caused diplomatic tensions between the U.S. and Iran to rise to very dangerous levels. Here to discuss the situation and how close we are to war, Middle East expert Juan Cole. So, Professor, we have a situation where John Bolton leaves the administration just days ago. He claims that he resigned. Trump claims that he fired him. And then it's almost as if, like, instead of a gold watch, there was a big gift that was sent to him in some way. It looked, and it's still quite possible, but it looked like the Trump administration was at least proclaiming a casus belli, as it were. But before we get into the specifics, will you just go back and just give us a brief summary of where we are with Iran, how far our relationship has disintegrated since the Obama Iranian nuclear deal, and the attempts, the most recent attempts to sort of, I guess, by France in particular, to create a new deal that looked a lot like the old deal, but presumably would be referred to as Trump's deal.
That's right. Well, you know, it's amazing to think about it, but in 2016, after the Iran nuclear deal was signed, there was a prospect that Iran might buy 100 passenger jets from Boeing. All the sanctions were supposed to be off of Iran economically, and it was supposed to be let into the world economy. That was the United Nations Security Council took off all of its sanctions, and each of the major blocs, Europe and the United States and so forth, were supposed to as well. So there's this prospect of you know, this burgeoning economy, it's an economy as large as Poland's with a population the size of Germany, would be a new player in the world scene. And there was a lot of money to be made by Americans. And then in May of 2018,
Before we get to there, I just want to explore this just a little bit so that we can really fully grasp the implications. I mean, one of the things that was left out of the negotiations for that deal specifically was Iranian involvement in groups that the United States considers to be terrorist groups, you know, arguably insurgencies and whatnot. But the nukes had been basically taken off the table. And you might have a better sense of this than I. Commercial engagement with different countries tends to increase America's, I guess, leverage in these instances, right? I mean, there's only so much that we can do with China, which has been horrible in terms of human rights abuses. But when you're talking about a dynamic between Iran and America, the idea that they would buy 100 U.S. Planes from Boeing not only is obviously a huge boon for Boeing and American interests, but also it begins to bring Iran back into the sort of the fold, as it were, and could have only led to probably more leverage. Yes.
Oh, I think absolutely. Once Iran has a lot of investment from Europe and the United States, a lot of trade with those places, when it does something that its hardliners really want to do, that the rest of the world is just horrified at, then there's going to be, you know, an avenue of pressure on Iran because it's no longer isolated. And that's why, you know, the hardliners in Iran like Iran's isolation. They were against the Obama deal, and they were very much afraid that it would open Iran to these outside influences.
And so, okay, so then that just basically gives us a vision of what could have been. Of course, that was not to be, at least for the time being, because you were about to tell us what the Trump administration did to sort of end that progress.
Well, the Trump administration breached the treaty. It was a treaty, and it was signed by President Obama, and it was signed by the other members of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, along with Germany as a kind of representative of the European Union. And what it said was that if Iran closed off all of its plausible avenues towards weaponizing its civilian nuclear enrichment program, because the Iranians have only ever had a civilian program which was intended to provide fuel to reactors and make electricity. But there was always this fear that maybe they might wake up one morning and decide to weaponize it. The agreement made that impossible. There's frequent inspections. Only certain kinds of equipment could be used. They were limited in the number of centrifuges. They couldn't have a heavy water nuclear reactor, which theoretically, you know, you could build up some fissile material on the rods inside. And so Iran was just not in a position really to at least secretly make a nuclear weapon if it ever wanted to. It would have to throw out the inspectors and build installations that were obvious to the world. So the Iran nuclear issue went on a back burner. It was really over with for the foreseeable future. And then Trump just pulled out of that treaty. He expected Iran to abide by the terms of the treaty, but then he went around the world strong-arming Japan and South Korea and India and other countries, Italy and so forth, not to buy Iranian petroleum, and using the might of the U.S. Treasury Department, which oversees a $22 trillion a year economy in the United States, a fourth of the world's economy, threatened everybody and his uncle that if they so much as traded with Iran or invested in Iran, that they would be fined billions of dollars. So, for instance, the oil company Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, was planning to develop Iranian natural gas fields, which are very extensive, and it abruptly pulled out when Trump did this. And so Iran has been reduced to a shadow of its former self economically. Last May, it got down to selling only 250,000 barrels a day of petroleum. It had been selling twice that much, 2.5 million barrels a day. And that's Iran's major source of income. It has carpets and pistachios and so forth, but they don't amount to that much. So the Iranian middle class has suffered this massive downward mobility. People, you know, are buying rotten cabbage at the store and can't afford you know, antibiotics and medicines for their family and their children and their grandmothers. They're really suffering very badly. And mind you, there's no legal framework for doing this to Iran. That is to say, the international community, the UN Security Council, says Iranian trade is perfectly licit. And the European Union thinks it's licit and is trying to, you know, find ways to get around Trump. And the U.S. Congress has not voted to do this. So it's just this Trump and his cronies have decided to get Iran and to starve it out and have dragooned the world into it with basically, you know, organized crime kinds of threats. It's a nice company you have here. Too bad something happened to it.
Right. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, let's start with the overtures from Iran via France to sort of, I guess, restart the deal in some way. And then let's talk about this latest incident in which the administration, anyways, claims that Iran has struck a Saudi oil facility. We will talk about what our relationship with Saudi Arabia is that would compel us to go to war for it. I'm Sam Seder. We're talking to Professor Juan Cole. Be right back. Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking with Middle East expert Juan Cole about the drone strike on a Saudi oil field earlier this week. So, Professor, in the last segment, you basically walked us through the demise of the Obama administration negotiated Iranian nuclear deal and a vision of what could have come in the wake of that deal were it not for the fact Donald Trump's hostility towards the deal. I don't know if his hostility was ideological, or he certainly had people in the Republican Party who were very excited at the idea that he would crash the deal. I think it also he is determined, it appears, to destroy anything that is a function of Barack Obama's legacy in any way. And so he sacked the deal. And as you told us, went around the world to basically pressure our allies to not do business with Iran, although there was really no legal framework for any of this. It was more or less, you know, thuggery. Recently, there have been overtures from Iran via France in particular to revive the deal. Tell us about those. But then let's just talk about this, the latest incident where there is an attempt, and this is not the first in the past couple of months, to argue that Iran has essentially launched a war on Saudi Arabia, a direct one.
Sure. Well, yes, the European Union and particularly France and Germany wanted to try to keep the nuclear deal alive, partly because they liked it and it was working. Iran was known to be in compliance, according to the UN inspectors. And they also still had lots of CEOs who fondly dreamed of getting into the Iranian market and bumping up the European economy. So this was very inconvenient for them that Trump acted in this way. And so they've been trying to find a way around him. They have set up something called Instex, which would allow European firms to trade with Iran, not in dollars, because the U.S. claims that any dollar trade is under the authority of the Treasury Department and sidestepping the major bank exchanges like SWIFT, which the U.S. is influential in. So Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, at the recent G7 meeting, sort of took the surprise initiative of inviting the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who negotiated the deal originally, and have consultations with him in hopes, I think, of getting a meeting between him and the Americans to start this process of renegotiating some kind of agreement. And Macron also suggested that maybe he could sweeten the whole thing with a $15 billion credit line to Iran to tide them over while negotiations are kickstarted. And, you know, lo and behold, it seems as though Trump didn't hate this. My analysis of him is that he felt as though his predecessors were patsies and just gave away the show, and that he can make a better deal than they did on China and Iran and everywhere. The way you do that is to bring the pain to the previous negotiating partners, announce that there's a new kid in town, and make it clear that the only way to remove the pain is to come to him and renegotiate.
Right.
And he's done that with China. He's done that to some extent, even with some of our European allies, and he's done it with Iran and North Korea. So, you know, in some instances, I think the North Koreans are very clever, and they figured out that there's no substance here. It's all showmanship. So they said, sure, we'll meet with you. We'd love that. The Iranians, you know, are feel mistreated by the West, and their government was overthrown in 1952, and they had a long period of dictatorship imposed on them, essentially by the CIA. And then they had a 79 revolution, which was a nativist revolution that put forward Iranian Shiite values against global capitalism. And so they're not the kind of people, ideologically speaking, to play the kind of game that I think the North Koreans have started to play, even though the origins of the two revolutions might be somewhat similar. And so the Iranians haven't come back to Trump, and this opening that Zarif tried to make and Macron seems to have been closed down by Iran's leader, clerical leader Ali Khamenei, who said that, sure, we'll talk to the Americans first. They should rejoin the 2015 agreement, and then we'll talk with them all they like.
Okay, we have about 3 minutes left. Let's just talk about the specifics of this latest attack on the Saudi interests. The argument from the administration has ranged from this was secretly launched by Iran to this could only have been done with Iranian weaponry by the Houthi. This is the one party in the Yemen civil war, which, you know, Saudi Arabia is actively fighting with our support. The other version was, there's general support for the Houthis. So if they did do it, it's basically like Iran doing it. Are any of these claims A, credible? And even if they were credible, to what extent is it necessary for us to get involved in a war on behalf of Saudi Arabia? We have no agreement, no mutual defense agreement with them. Why would we do this?
Right. Well, I think it's plausible that there's some kind of Iranian fingerprint on all this, whether it's an Iranian proxy or more direct. President Rouhani of Iran has actually said that if Iran's not allowed to export its petroleum from the Gulf, then nobody will be allowed to. So, you know, in a way, I think a lot of Iranians feel they've got nothing left to lose. If they're not going to be allowed to sell their oil, not going to be allowed to trade, they're going to be reduced to a fourth world country, then they intend to bring the pain to the people who are behind all this, which is partly the Saudis. You know, have been big cheerleaders for the American economic war on Iran, and an economic war always holds the potential for turning it into a violent war. My reading of Trump is that he won't want to commit to a conventional sort of warfare against Iran in response, even if Iran is plausibly credited with the attack. He might pull what he did in Syria or Afghanistan. You know, there have been two big instances in Trump's presidency where he just like bombed the enemy once.
Right.
And there was a lot of hoopla about it. He said he dropped the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan, which is kind of an echo of Saddam Hussein's dictator Arabic. And then we never heard anything more about it, right? So I think the most that will happen is that, at least initially. But it's dangerous even to do that because the U.S. has something on the order of 5,000 troops still in Iraq, which is Shiite territory, and most of the Iraqi Shiites are pro-Iran. So at that point where the United States is bombing Iran, the U.S. troop security is in the hands of the Shiites of Iraq, and that's a bad scene if it goes in this direction.
And presumably, 14,000. Right. I mean, presumably, the Pentagon is telling Donald Trump this. Well, Professor Juan Cole, I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your catching us up on this dynamic. And I guess this is something that we will see in the coming days and weeks if something goes further. But I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sam.
Juan Cole is the founder and chief editor of Informed Comment and the Richard P. Mitchell Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He's author of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. Just ahead, I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.